input.
Yeah, I agree. I don't really have to get up and go to go running outside to go play satellite anymore. This was about 25 years ago I was playing with that. I have a balcony here. I probably could do it, but I just haven't been sufficiently motivated. Anyway, 7-3, back to net, BB2BXO.
Okay, very good, Frank. So, Rich, W2BZ, happy, healthy New Year. You want to kind of make a comment about this?
Yep. This is W2BZ. Happy New Year to everyone. Whenever I think of satellite, hitting a satellite, it always amazes me that it doesn't take much power at all to hit a satellite. And when you think about the distances the signal has to travel, you wonder why that's true. And, you know, of course it comes down to frequency, but how does, you know, in the gigahertz band, the question is, how come you don't have to be running 1,000 watts or 2,000 watts to communicate with a satellite? Back to that.
AC2GS. Well, among other things, because you're not doing any propagation. You're not doing any reflection and refraction of the ionosphere. You're doing a direct point-to-point. And all that you're suffering is the losses, of the distance, the attenuation losses, the free space losses and such. But you're not the kind of smearing the signal over a massive area. You know, when you're propagating a transmission to other Earth stations, you're smearing it all over a wide area of both land and ocean.
So that's a function of the frequency. Just cuts right through the ionosphere and whatever else is in the way. And I get it's still a little counterintuitive for me. But because of the frequency, there are no electromagnetic obstacles in the way. Is that the right way to say it, Roy?
Yeah, you could say it like that. I mean, there's a bunch of analogies. They're not completely accurate, but hopefully they give people a good idea. It's sort of like the difference between collimated light and incandescent light bulb light that is isotropic and spreads 360 degrees. With a little bit of directionality, a high-frequency transmission isn't obscured by any of the layers of the Earth and can go straight to the point that you aim it at. So, you know, you don't get the losses of absorption as much as you do, or reflection or refraction or all the other dispersion characteristics of the lower frequencies in the ionosphere and just the atmosphere.
What's the lowest amount of power you can use to hit a satellite?
It sort of depends upon, you know, what the elevation is and what the frequency. We already kind of talked that as you raise the frequency, the free path loss increases, so it attenuates the signal and you need a little bit stronger signal. If it's in a low Earth orbit, you need less signal than if it's in a high Earth orbit. So there are a lot of variables. I mean, I'll ask David, since he's our maven, is there any specific kind of guideline to kind of eyeball what's the lowest practical amount of power to reach objects in different orbits?
Well, this is Ed Sewell again. But there isn't a specific rule of, well, there's a rule of thumb, basically, that there's so many factors involved. Well, I should say there isn't a rule of thumb, basically, because you have to take into account your antenna that you're using, the frequency you're using, the nature of the antenna on board the satellite, how that's oriented, whether the bird is spinning or not, whether the power of the satellite being used, the efficiency of the receiver on board the satellite. So I can't give you a definitive rule of thumb answer because there are many varying factors. There are a lot of moving parts.
Okay, that's legitimate. I kind of thought it was kind of that way. I mean, you know, it gets to the point of ridiculous that I wouldn't suggest that you try to transmit using microwatts. Because then you know, unless your satellite is next door. But yeah, I didn't want to put you on a hard spot, David. But I just thought any answer that you gave me would be of interest to me.
Roy, what are the other electromagnetic obstacles besides the ionosphere between Earth and a satellite?
Well, again, it depends upon the frequency. Under some frequencies, water droplets can have an absorptive effect. So, I mean, there are different gases and there are vapors and all kinds of interesting little chemicals up in the atmosphere that interact with different frequency of electromagnetic spectrum. So it's a complicated picture. The most obvious that everyone here is aware of is the ionosphere's effect on lower frequency, where if you're lucky, it traps your electromagnetic waves, because usually you don't want them going into space. At one point, someone asked the question of, you know, will there be more Martian satellites that amateur radio operators can try to contact? Well, yeah, probably, eventually. But for those, you certainly don't want anything that interacts with the ionosphere.
Is the ionosphere the big obstacle, and once you break through that, it's sort of your home free, no matter where in space you're aiming at?
Well, to a degree. The ionosphere has a kind of two-sided situation, whereas, you know, water vapor and such can just scatter and or absorb RF. There are beneficial things to the ionosphere. It acts as a refracting medium that bends the radio waves the same way that a prism bends light beams, and so allows you to propagate your signal across the world. So in one way it's beneficial, and the other way it's detrimental, as opposed to just the contaminants in the atmosphere that act to absorb and or scatter RF, which are all kind of detrimental. So, but the bottom line is, the most important thing if you want to get your radio waves past the ionosphere is to get it at enough of an energy where the ionosphere, even the F1 and F2 layer, have very little refractive effect upon it, and it just sails right through.
Now, what is it about the high frequencies, 1, 2, 3 gigahertz, that allow a signal to sail past the ionosphere? What is it about, you know, high frequency? What are they doing that low frequency signals don't do?
It's the nature of electromagnetism. Electromagnetism, the characteristics are highly dependent upon their frequency and their energy carrying capacity. As you increase the frequency of electromagnetic waves, you change their characteristics and you increase their ability, the amount of energy that they contain. And how they interact with ionized gases. For low frequencies, ionized gases cause the low frequency electromagnetic waves to refract because they're lower energy and or lower frequencies, two sides of the same coin. If you get the energy level high enough, the ionization of the ionosphere has negligible effects, because the electromagnetic waves are so high energy to begin with that they don't really interact. They don't cause any refraction. So they seal through it as though it was not there. Yeah, it's the same thing with a lot of different mediums. Glass is transparent for visible light, but it's opaque for ultraviolet light and infrared light. So, you know, you could say the same thing. Well, what is it about glass that has that bandpass filter to it? It's just the nature of how the atoms are bound together and the electron bonding that takes place, of how different energy levels of electromagnetism have different effects on different mediums.
Okay, that's a good explanation. And in terms of propagation, I haven't been on my 440 in about a year, and I wonder how the low bands are doing in general. Any effects of the sunspot cycle? Is it really some good activity out there, or is it still sort of meh?
Well, I mean, I spend most of my time, since my antenna is a 10-meter antenna, on 10 meters, and propagation is pretty good. It was abysmal during the spring and the summer, possibly because of the geomagnetic storms. That was the theory. But nowadays, those things are gone, and I talk to a bunch of people across the United States on Sunday mornings. When you get to the lower frequencies, theoretically, if sunspot activity is very active, it usually is detrimental for the D layer and produces more background noise in 160 and 80 meters. I don't really stay there, so I don't know how good, bad, or indifferent it is. But usually, good sunspot activity is great for the higher HF bands and not so great for the lower HF bands.
All right. And if I might ask Paul, how's 40 meters doing? I know you're on it a lot. If you're listening, go ahead.
Okay. Right. Let me see if I have it. Not on 40. 20. Now I'm on 20. I got a different rig, and I am now happy to be back on 20 CW.
You mean you abandoned that miracle piece of electronics called a Kenwood 440?
Oh, yeah, you should get another rig every 30 years or so. Yeah, I kept losing bands, you know. It was only a matter of time. What are you going to do? I mean, I sent it in years ago, twice, and all they do is duplicate the same thing that was... the same thing over and over again, so they don't fix anything. Back to you.
Paul, what did you get?
IC7300, most common rig out there.
And let me ask you, is it a world of difference on the receiving end between the 7300 and the 440?
Yeah, by my ear, not even close. It would be fun to hook the two up together and switch back and forth, but this thing comes with, right off the bat, it's got three filters that, you know, let's say you're on CW. You know, you tune in, and you hear noise off to the side, you hit that filter, and it tightens things up, and then you can even tighten it up again. And, you know, it's to a point where when you do that, all I hear is at one station, you know. So it's remarkable where the Kenwood 440 came with the ability to put filters in, but back in those days they wanted like $80, which is, I guess, like, you know, $100 nowadays, I guess. They wanted like $80, you know, for the filter, so I never did that. And I had no problem with it. You know, I just got used to it. But it would have been better if it had filters. But I never put them in. Back to you, Ed. I with you, Rich.
Was somebody else in there?
BB2BXO.
Yeah, Frank?
Yeah, I think it was somebody asking about 40 meters or about the TS-440. Go ahead.
It was both, actually. I made comments about, you know, wondering how 40 meters is doing propagation-wise, and I know Paul had a 440, still does, I guess, and that's been my rig for the last 40 years.
Yeah, I was just on 40 meters around sunset, a little after sunset, a couple of hours ago. HL5FUA in South Korea was coming through, though just above the noise level, using a remote site in Connecticut. Earlier in the sunspot cycle, he was quite a bit louder than he tends to be this winter. I did work on one of the South Korean stations on 40 on CW, HL2WA, and got it confirmed just after sunset about a week ago. You know, so if you're, you know, there is some pretty good propagation on 40 meters. Those signals don't necessarily seem to be as loud as they were earlier in the sunspot cycle. Go ahead.
All right. I thought 40 and 80 aren't really affected that much by the sunspot cycle. Isn't that right, Roy?
Well, it's not make or break, but usually the background noise level goes up over the sunspot peaks.
Ah, okay. I know the lightning strikes and a lot of other noise during the summertime. It's really troublesome on 40 and 80, but I don't know. I made my magnetic loop. I increased the size of it because I wanted to go from 10 to 80, and I sort of shot myself in the foot because I lost 10, 15, and 80. So it's sitting out in front of my house in pieces, and I have to get myself motivated to put it back together again and make it the same dimensions I originally had. Anyway, I don't want to hog things. Roy, back to you. This is W2BZ.
You're always welcome here, Rich. Well, you know, the old saying, the grass is always greener. So you had a good antenna. It worked, but you wanted something better. So sometimes that works out. Sometimes you reinvent the wheel, but other times not so good. So I'm sure your eye will turn to your magnetic loop again. You were such a fan of the technology, and we'll hear all kinds of things in future technical nets. I thank you, as always, Rich, for your participation in these technical nets.
All righty, well, I'll listen out, and I appreciate it. And once again, everybody have, I came up with a new saying. I told my kids and some of my friends that 2025 will be a year of good surprises. Let's hope it is. All right, Roy, go ahead. W2BZ.
Okay, I hope you're right with that. We could use a couple of good years. We've had some rocky years in the near past, so we'll see what the future brings us. So thanks, everyone. Gee, we really kind of bounced that first question of Jeff's back, forth, and sideways. You never know. If you would have asked me if that question would have taken up about an hour and 10 minutes of the technical net, I would have been surprised, but that's the beauty of the technical net. So thanks to Jeff for starting the ball going, and all the other people in the middle, especially our satellite maven, David, into AAM. Anyway, let's see if Hank is still with us. I hope he hasn't had to go someplace. So, Hank, if you're out there, you're next. Are you out there, N1YDY? We'll come back to Hank a little bit later. John, KB2AGP, are you with us still?
I'm here. I have a general scanner question, and also another question on, I heard on WABC, the Bonnet-Along walkie-talkie that can talk across the country. They're in the commercial band, they're not in the amateur band, but if you have any comment on them. Also, I'm looking to scan on the internet, like railroad, Long Island Railroad, New York City Transit Authority. I'm down here in Florida. I guess you got them kind of like a train book. But is there anything out there developed that you may know about that you know?
Okay, I think we sort of brought that subject up about a year ago. The problem is, as time goes on, the problem becomes a bigger problem. As Wes mentions occasionally, modern commercial communications is progressively becoming more and more encrypted, and so it's blocked. There are services out there that charge fees that let you kind of listen in. You can do web searches. There used to be a thing, and it's still around, and I'm not really aware of how big they are. It's called TuneIn Radio, and they seem to have access to a lot of audio streams, mostly of live radio, but probably of other things. So you could look at TuneIn .com, and they have a premium fee and a free account. So go with the free account unless you find something you can't live without. So I mean, I'll again throw it out to the general public. As far as I'm aware, there's no these company that just kind of concentrates all of these commercial communication services and allows you to listen in through the internet. But there are probably still bits and pieces of it in existence. Anyone with any other ideas other than TuneIn Radio?
W2BZ2RY.
Yeah, first Rich, then David, and then Wes.
I'm sure if you Google like train spotting or something else like that, if you're interested in listening to trains, a lot of sites probably have a section of the site where you can listen in, like live ATC for aviation. I'm sure there are tons of sites on the internet that you can listen in to train communications. Go ahead.
Okay, well, you know, like I used to say, Google is your friend, although it was a better friend 5-6 years ago than it is now, where it's trying to be an artificial intelligence, and it's also trying to brand things, and it's also trying to increase the sponsorship and make a lot more money. So you can always Google these things. David, you wanted to say something on the subject?
Broadcastify.com.
Broadcast.
There's a program called police scanner.
iHeart.
Police scanner.com.
many of these stations have their own streams.
It is ad
you want to find
so
it.
You will see and hear
I really don't know anything about listening to train communications.
They have literally hundreds of thousands of feeds from all across the country and 200 feeds from the New York area alone, and some of them do include railroads, maritime frequencies, etc. So hopefully that'd be a good starting point for you. This is N2AM.
Okay, very good, David. Yes, I've seen and heard Broadcastify. I don't think I use their services ever, but yeah, that's a very good thing to experiment and to check out what they have. We have two Davids tonight, and I guess I confused them. So now let's hear from KG2RY.
Hello. I don't know anything about train communications. Know that radio broadcast is accessible on TuneIn and also on iHeart, maybe some other radio apps that you can download from the internet. And what to say, it seems like, let's say you're in one city and you want all the broadcasts to be from one city and they're all divided among the providing websites and streaming services.
But about 6 months ago, I pointed out that there was a nice little place that had streams across the world, radiogarden.net or something like that. So, you know, I mean, there are, you know, there's so much audio and there's so much throughput and, you know, a lot of different groups of people are trying to turn these things into profitable things, but until they are, it's a lot of them are free. So, you know. As long as they're there, kind of use them. Wes, what did you want to say on this subject?
Yeah, thanks, Sheehan. I have a friend who was the active scanner user, and he was trying to listen to everything possible, and he says everything is dead right now. You're downloading the apps and they don't work, or they don't work the way that they used to work, so it's not worth his time, so he stopped it. And he was like for 15 years doing that, from everything that he was able to scan. I'm also afraid that it's close to the time Paul is going to talk, so we have run out of time for my subject and question.
Not really, Wes. You know, I don't expect this particular topic to go on for an hour and a half, and you're up next. John, hopefully you got some ideas. You got Broadcastify. You got TuneIn.com. Don't give them any money. Try out their free services if they're available. And, you know, as Wes said, most likely 10 years ago, it would have been a much better experience. Because generally speaking, public communication systems are kind of going encrypted as far as I perceive.
AG2DU.
AG2RY.
Yes, AD2DU.
Just want to say quickly, from my house in Astoria, I get Amtrak, I get the subway yard, and it's driving around. You can get the subway in different locations. I picked it up in Brooklyn and Windsor Terrace recently. So they're definitely still out there. Oh, there's a lot not on the trunks. All the local police precincts, too. 82 to you.
Okay, but that's kind of local pickings. The question, I guess, possibly, that John is interested in is a more regional or wider range of transmissions that someone is kind of feeding through the internet, so that, you know, it's just not, you know, within 5 miles of its home there in Florida.
Are any of the web SDRs VHF, UHF?
I would assume so, but I don't know whether they get out of the amateur radio frequencies. Some of the people who run these things kind of lock them to specific bands.
Yeah, I hear it a lot. I think it's 161-500. But thank you for the info.
Okay, very good. KG2RY, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I want to ask a question regarding what you're discussing. My question is, does real radio, radio with a volume control and a speaker, does it sound better than radio coming from a stream?
It depends, unfortunately. You can't definitively say one thing or another. You're kind of describing the difference between digitalized audio and analog audio, because if you're kind of setting up two parameters. One is a digital stream that gets converted to analog audio. The other one kind of sounds like it started and ended as analog. And, you know, there are guys who love analog who would tell you that digital introduces distortions that they can perceive and annoys them. And there are other guys who say that that's all nonsense. So it depends upon both your ability to hear and your internal perceptions of reality. You know, it depends. You know, guys who live and die for vinyl. I don't give a damn about vinyl. Vinyl causes hissing and crackling and all kinds of obvious audio distortion. I don't care if they grow used to it because they listen to it for so long, but, you know, if they want vinyl and they're not going to charge me to buy a vinyl, you know, let them spend their own money. God bless them all.
Vinyl isn't always good. It can be very good. And the same with CDs, you know. I think you'll get better luck with CDs than with vinyl. But I have to go because the space station is starting to come through here.
Okay, David, good luck.
Thank you, Roy.
Okay, well, let's get to you, Wes. What's your questions for tonight?
Yeah, I have Antoine Shane, I have a few sounds. I'm going to go quick through all of them. CW decoding. There is a radio Xiegu, X-I-E-G-U, X6100, and right from the display you have a decoding of CW. You could see, so for the people who have graphic skills for CW, at least for the receiving of the CW, they have some kind of help. And then there is a CW decoder's Morse code that is available at $16.59 on eBay. There is also CW RTQY, PSK, DMR, CW Trainer that is available through ARRL. And there is a bunch of programs, but mostly they are paid programs. There is one that is not paid, Hamscope. This one gives you PSK 31, BPSK, QPSK, RTTY, ASCII, MFSK 16 packets, CW, and whatsoever. So this program is available for free, and there is MRP40 Morse decoder, which is pretty much old program, but still good, and it's a successor of MRP-37 that would actually help ham operators. The only question that I have in this area is there any other radio that is displaying CW in form of text on the front panel? Back to you, Doctor.
Yes, we sort of actually covered this last week. I'm not aware of the feature set. You know, there's different radios that out of nowhere happen to be able to decode CW or decode FT8. I prefer, and I mentioned it last week, something called CW Skimmer. It is a commercial product. I think there's a trial period. What I like about CW Skimmer as opposed to all those others is those others will kind of tune in on a single audio CW signal and translate it if they can. CW Skimmer will take a band spread of 192 kilohertz and spit out, you know, 30 different CW conversations at the same time on an extended window. So I really like CW Skimmer personally.
Okay. The next one is DigiPi. DigiPi allows to operate amateur radio using nothing more than a Raspberry Pi and Wi-Fi device, things like WSJTX or JS8 call run like apps on your phone. All configuration is done via a web browser, and DigiPi makes great APRS, TNC, DigiPeter at AX25 node. This release makes a lot of changes under the hood and provides APRS web chat. So that's the information for those who are interested in it, and I'm going to the next one. I'm not trying to spend too much. What is the right choice? I've got your email. Thank you very much. But I would like you to make a comment again on the Technet Legend job. Okay. When we have a decision to make, we tend to focus on making the right decision. We might spend a lot of time weighing the pros and cons of each choice, having a bunch of professional VNA and even HP 4194 gain phase analyzer that is more than 4 years old. I noticed that each one gives unique benefits and features other VNAs do not have. But of course, Dr. Roy got a nano VNA, so I decided to try it. I assume that 4-inch display and connectors built in is the best I could get, and I was wrong. My fingers are still too big for it. I discovered that there is another one, as the V4401A, and that one is 7-inch and has capacitive touchscreen. It costs $339, and this one is like the dream to have something that is portable. Because heavy stuff I'm not gonna get with me more than I'm not gonna even take it out of the rack if it's a 60 pounds unit. So another question is that, of course, I could buy the other one, but I still have the one that I purchased 2 weeks ago, and what am I going to do with it? What is the right choice for the story?
AC2GS, and as I answered in the email, it depends on the individual. It depends upon what they're looking for, what they need, and what they can afford. If I wanted a sturdy, portable, easily manipulated VNA that's one port, I would take my Rig Expert 500, which costs about $500, about the same price as your 7-inch VNA type of thing, and I'd be happy with that. I bought the Nano VNA as a toy, it's about 150 plus or minus, and it True, I'd rather have the 4-inch than the 2.5-inch and probably the 7-inch, but to pay 3 times the price for 7-inch when I can just run a PC program, plug it into a USB port, and have a 34-inch monitor copy what's going on the screen. True, it's not portable, but, you know, again, if I want to really be portable, I'll use my Rig Expert. If I don't want to be portable and I'd like to play around with a dual-port high bandwidth VNA, I'll use the Super Nano VNA. But, you know, some people love the old stuff, so it's not a bad thing to them that it weighs 70 pounds and takes up half their desk. To me, that would be a deal killer. But again, it's up to the individual. What depends what they're looking for, what they can afford to pay for it. All those things come to mind.
Thank you very much for that comment, and I'm going to put on hold my dream of having a 7-inch display. Yeah, I agree with you. Although I would like to have a spectrum analyzer and a vector network analyzer in one unit, but I don't think something below $1,000 would be available on the market. I think.
Well, that's another factor. If you wait long enough and the world doesn't come to an end, all things are possible for the most part, but it violates the laws of physics. So is it possible that in 30 years there's going to be a single one-chip DNA and a single one-chip spectrum analyzer, and someone in China is going to put the two of them together in a little box and charge what nowadays would go for something like $100 or $150? Probably. But the question is, you want to wait for 30 years? I certainly don't.
Absolutely. I agree. So another option is just to buy separate spectrum analyzer that is also $150 and is available on eBay. The next object is magnetic loop 40 meters to 10 meters built in by 2E0ERO. Okay, now what is special about that magnetic loop, because we were talking about the different kind of magnetic loops, well, it's extremely well made. Absolutely extremely well made. For the guy who sells it for $136.65. So it is good for balcony, backyard, mats, or inside the house if you want it. Now, the good thing is that it's motorized and it's covering 8 bands, 40, 30, 20, 17 meters in one mode. So we're talking about 20, 17, 15, 12, 11, and 10 meters in one antenna. And with the motor kit to make tuning easier, all you have is little things on your desk, and you can maneuver with this. So the guy charged approximately $47.54, and this is again the for shipping to the United States, and this is again a magnetic loop 40 to 10 meters built by 2E0. ERO. I sent to Dr. Roy a few pictures of it. It's absolutely something. Now, the only bad thing I see about it is that the capacitor that is with the motor is not covered with any plastic. Dr. Roy.
ACP.
Yes, you are.
Yes, David.
Could you put me on the list for questions?
Okay, but that would put you right after Brian. So I don't know how much time we're going to have left, but certainly, yeah, I'll put you on the list. And, you know, if we have time, we'll do it. That's why I tell people to kind of come early and put their name on the list so we don't have these problems. But consider yourself on the list, but, you know, it is 9:47, so I don't know how, you know, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen, but consider yourself on the list. Okay, David?
I don't have a lot to say, but thank you. And if I don't get a chance to ask my questions, you know, it can always wait till next week. KG2RY.
Okay, that's very good attitude to have, David. And getting back to you, Wes, I don't know. I don't know what to make of this. You sent me some stuff. The links were broken, so there appears to be no real place. Maybe in Facebook you can buy it from this guy. I don't buy things on Facebook. So that's a definite, you know, some guy in some country is building something. I don't have the faintest idea what the real price is, because they seem to show pictures and they say it comes motorized and non-motorized. So what does that mean to the price? I don't have the faintest idea what the power handling capacity of it based on the information. I went to the reviews. No one mentioned how much power you could put through it. So, you know, all of this to me is semi-worthless. There's a couple of nice pictures that shows a little sturdy mini loop that's bent into a pretzel. Okay, but I don't have a clue what their 40-meter capability is. Usually, the problem with the magnetic loops is unless you really build them big, as you go to lower and lower frequencies, their effective efficiencies approach zero. That's not a good approaching. So I wasn't particularly impressed. I've seen loads of magnetic loops with more legitimate kind of reputations and retailers and people who will fix it. We now have to send it to Estonia or someplace. So I wasn't terribly impressed. And the loop's been out for, I think, something like 8-9 years, so it's not like it's a brand new thing, and I never heard of it, but that doesn't mean much. But still, I wasn't impressed in the slightest, because it was very iffy. I wouldn't trust people. They don't have any reputation. You know, I mean, maybe among themselves they got a great reputation, but in order to kind of check people out, you know, a couple of Estonians just playing a joke that can generate all the stuff that I saw. Better than what I saw, like often websites where, you know, you get the 407 errors.
Interesting. When I have a problem like you describe, I always go to Hamnet, and in Hamnet for 2E0ERO magnetic loop, there are 5 stars comments on it from the people who bought it, and they say, $110, $155. They also say the quote in euros, depends who was buying that. And you're right, absolutely. If on 28 megahertz there is 83-87%, then close to 40 you might have a 2%. The effectiveness of antenna is very important. If the antenna has a motor, even though it is extremely narrow, you can still manage it. Some people say, well, I don't see too much on the waterfall because the antenna bandwidth is so narrow at this particular frequency. But for comparison, there is Kiro Mazzoni, automatic magnetic loop antenna, so that was on Hamvention 2024, and then this thing is something that is professionally made, and it handles the power up to 1 kilowatt, but you pay $2,097.97. They also have something like a stealth, a version of the magnetic loop antenna. It has some sort of activator that is, looks like it's hydraulic, but this antenna costs $1,799.99. And of course, if you want to have something really good, that would be the antenna that was at Hamvention, that is Kiro Mazzoni. Sony automatic magnetic loop antenna, MIDI, and it was a drone. This one is 2,417.9077 cents. The problem that I see with that is also the capacitor is not covered with the plastic, but they have $169.99 in addition, the cap that you can put over it and be happy. They also have a replacement part, which is zero Masoni loop antenna actuator, and that actuator that looks like a pneumatic or hydraulic cylinder. I believe it's pneumatic, is also available to be purchased. So that's that much for the antenna. Let me drop. And the next one is gravity propulsion system in the manifesto of Matthew Leibelsberger. This one is touchy. I'm saying from the beginning of it that I'm trying to talk about gravity, not all of the things around, but the subject was triggered by manifesto supposedly sent by Matthew Leibelsberger, the guy who died in the Tesla in front of the Trump Tower Hotel. Let me go. So we don't know whether he killed himself, and then after he was killed, he activated the mechanism for the blow up in it, or he did it before, or what? We don't have the information. But the thing is that the nonsense of anti-gravity rejected by science has much more interesting story, and that is what I would like to talk on the TechNet. Matthew Leibelsberger was presented to us as a decorated veteran suffering post-traumatic stress disorder, and officially published footage in the video shows Washington D.C. press release confirmed by the speaker the presence of the letter that was supposedly Matthew's Leibelsberger. In the video shows also the press release that was sent by me that there was the information found in other sources. So the sources says that in December 31st, 2024, there was a letter sent in form of email to NPR, the National Public Radio, and to Sean Ryan show that has 3.6 million subscribers on YouTube by Matthew. Half an hour after the release of the episode by the show, Ryan account posted a screenshot on the email received from the sender, who was the guy, and the email says, the drones that appeared all over New Jersey were the Chinese origin. The drones that appears over New Jersey were the Chinese origin and use gravitic propulsion system. These are the most dangerous threat to national security that ever existed. I just don't understand why the guy who killed himself was talking about the national security threat, and then he committed the suicide. So something is not right in it. And the second time is not important to us that he made from the perspective of discussion about gravity. The owner of the show, Ryan and Shoemate, they said many times that they weren't able to verify those facts, and he said that he's going to disappear for a few days due to the consequences of releasing that information. Let me drop. Okay, the material for the discussion is United States Gravity Control Propulsion System, and we have here the history of gravity. So in 1687, there was Isaac Newton theory, then we had in 1859 planet Vulcan, 1905 special relativity, 1907 Einstein predict gravitational redshift, in 1915 general relativity, in 1917 Einstein theorized simulated emission, 1918 prediction of frame drag, 1919 first observation of gravitation, 1925 first measurement of gravity shift, 1937 prediction of galactic transit, 1959 gravitation certified, and 1960 invented using simulated emission. Now in 1960, first evidence of black holes. So we think that this is the old knowledge, but it's only 1960s that we've heard about it. 1966, first observation about gravitational time delays. 1969, fourth detection of gravitational waves. 1974, indirect evidence for gravitational waves. 1979, first observation of galactic gravitational lens. And then we have a legal in 1979. Then we have for 2002 LIGO starts first search, and 2004 frame dragging probe. And then we have a number of the events for LIGO that we have, and in 2014 we have advanced LIGO upgrade, 2015 false alarm for gravitational wave, and then 2016 gravitational wave detection. But I'm going to ask Dr. Roy, what is the time dilation, time curvature vector?
Hey, C2GS. Well, unfortunately, there's someone who doesn't like your stroll-down gravity leg. So if you can concisely repeat the question that you asked me, because I didn't get it.
Okay. What is the gravity from the perspective of space-time and time dilation? Back to the story.
Okay. Unfortunately, quantum mechanics doesn't really work terribly well with gravity, quantum gravity. There's really no good theory explaining almost any of it. There are special cases in radiation from black holes, but otherwise quantum gravity is kind of that's what causes all these guys to wander around talking about string theory and such. Our primary understanding of how gravity works as an interaction, not quite a real force, but an interaction, is that of time dilation. In warped space-time, time is dilated, and there's something very similar to momentum, you know, MVP type of thing. There's something called foramomentum, which is velocity and time. So if you slow down in time, you have to speed up in velocity in order to conserve your foramomentum. And that speeding up in velocity is what we feel as a force acting as gravity upon us. So the bottom line is on a relativistic terms, gravity is due to time dilation and conservation of momentum in space-time.
Okay, so the video that I have sent you, that video says that the time is different in space, and the time is different in Earth, and we take the smaller distance, we could say that the time between your head and your feet is different. So everything is about the gradient that we could think about it. Imagine the gradient that in space that gradient is faster. So we made so the video says that something must fall because the head is moving faster than the legs. That was the analogy for it in the tall building.